I'd like to call the regular meeting of the Finance Committee to order.
Mr. Chairman,
you have a
motion to certification for the Board of Directors meeting in executive session of today. I move that the board certify to the best of each member's knowledge and with no individual member dissenting that at the just concluded board executive session of February 12th, 2015, only such matters as are authorized for discussion in executive session under board bylaws Article 10 and only those matters identified in the notice by which the executive session was convened were heard, discussed, or considered by the board. Right here, second. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. With respect to the agenda that's before us, with the board's permission, I'd like to switch the items. We have some people signed up for public comment on the budget-related matters, and it would make sense to do that first and then move on to the NBTA a discussion as our second agenda item, if that's okay with the committee. Hearing no objection. Let me just kick off what we're trying to achieve this afternoon with the agenda. We have two action items and two information items that we'll take up at the end of the session. Our first action item deals with continuation of our discussions with respect to the 2016 budget. We've had a couple of committee meetings. We've had a couple of work sessions. We are deeply into this. We understand how challenging a budget year this is for us and for the jurisdictions. The board and management have been working over this period since it was first shown to us late last year to identify cost savings, to bring down the initially proposed subsidy request to the jurisdictions. We've considered several strategies to produce a balanced budget. Among those, consideration of targeted reductions in service or consideration of modest increase in fares. We're still early in the budget process. We will not complete that until May when we adopt the budget. But if we are to consider service and fares, it is important to have that conversation with our riders, with our other stakeholders. To do that requires that we lay out the options that are to be considered. And as such, the docket that we have in front of us today would become, if we recommend it to the board and if the board adopts it, the outer limit of changes the board could consider in balancing the budget. We could always do less, but we could do no more if we do not start the process of docketing these changes. What's in the draft represents some tough choices. We definitely want to listen to our customers and our stakeholders, both today and through any future hearing process, as to the adverse impacts that these choices would have, as to the conditions that would require us to consider that. We also recognize that with what has happened on Capitol Hill, the reduction of the transit benefit, and I think Mr. Bulger might have some good news on that later, but our customers are faced by tax policy that is now making it much more expensive for them to ride trains, and as we've seen in the ridership analysis over the last few months, they are making that choice. Literally, you can see that at the midpoint of the month, when their transit benefit has run out, they run out on our service and get back on the roads. Our strong preference, which we've expressed over the last several years, is that a policy that deals with fare increases only every other year is far more equitable, avoids the kinds of changes, the kinds of actions that would discourage ridership, worsen traffic, hurt the region's economy. So what I'm recommending today is that we do consider, I think we should amend as necessary, but take this docket as something that is necessary to have alive for the time being, and to be moved to the board, but that we continue our efforts over the next 2 weeks before the board meeting to see if there are other alternatives to fares and service cuts that would not unduly burden the jurisdictions. And whether we can find ways to do that, that we can all live within our means, that would be a preferable outcome. A preferable outcome to going forward with the docket, even if we did not ultimately have to take those actions. We should know now whether that is necessary. If it is not necessary, at least my view and others that I've talked to, we should not proceed with it unless it's a must. But if it is going to be necessary to close the budget gap, unfortunately, we have to act on it this month in order to have it with us. The review over the next couple of weeks would be to look at whether there are further management actions that could tighten the belts, whether we can do that without impacting our customers, which would be preferable. Are there ways that we can look at our capital budget, which is also a draw on, in some respects, cash provided from the jurisdictions, and align it more closely with what actually will be done next year? We're always optimistic about what will be spent in terms of capital. We never quite seem to reach that, but we were burdening the jurisdictions with the necessity of having money set aside to do that. If that isn't a requirement, it could be a help in putting a package together. We might also look at perhaps some non-safety projects that could be deferred, although we've already deferred a number of them as we looked down the road to this year. But I want to emphasize that we must also look at the capital program that we will adopt in May as part of the budget process in order to preserve the funding that's necessary for safety, for state of good repair, including any recommended improvements that we might determine are needed, especially those that might come, those additional recommendations that may come from the National Transportation Safety Board or the Federal Transit Administration or from our own reviews in the wake of the incident at L'Enfant Plaza. I'm grateful we do have members of the public here today as we start this conversation. It is a conversation we need to have. It doesn't just happen inside Metro. It is a regional set of decisions. We hope it will shape the parameters of the conversation that the Metro staff, the board, and the jurisdictional staffs need to have over the next couple of weeks. I think, and staff that I've been working with, believe there is potentially a solution that's out there. I'd like to explore that completely before the next board meeting. If we can identify that way forward, we could pull back, not totally. There are some things in the docket that need to be put forward for operational reasons or otherwise. But if we can get there, we certainly should owe it to our public to not put them through the hurdles that would be inherent in going through a fare increase process at this time. The second action item on the agenda will be the discussion of acceptance of money from the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority. This has been before us now for more than a year of how we can accept money for things we want to do, that Virginia wants to pay for, that are in the interests of the region, but have to be embodied in some form of agreement. There's some bus work in this category. There's also some rail work. I've been looking at it. I don't want to consider this as a Virginia problem. I think for some time we've been saying that's a Virginia problem. It is a Metro problem. People who want to invest in our system have to be able to work it out with them to get that money to work. So we'll need to discuss that. At the end, we will have an update on the addressing of the Financial Management Oversight Review findings, continued progress being made there, continued discussions with the Federal Transit Administration, but a lot of progress. And then lastly, we do want to get an update from the staff on current year budget performance. We're now halfway through the fiscal year. Part of the concern about next year's budget is, will there be a deficit occurred in this year that will have to be made up next year, or can we feel relatively confident that this year will close on a balanced basis, and all we're looking at for the future is the need to make 2016 work. So we still have a lot of work ahead of us. I certainly will hope that our jurisdictional representatives on the board will encourage their staff and the various jurisdiction staffs to get in a room with us and see if there isn't a way to make this work. I've talked to each of the jurisdictions in one way or another about how much of a budget reduction would be necessary to deal with their real financial problems, and I see it as something that's within reach if we all work together to make that happen. But we need to understand everything better. Part of that understanding will be what we hear from our stakeholders and our public in the next few minutes. And with that, I would open up the public comment period. In the order they signed up, let me call first Stuart Schwartz, and after him, Terry Clower. 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Stuart Schwartz. I'm the executive director of the Coalition for Smarter Growth. We're an 18-year-old organization dedicated to sustainable growth through walkable, transit-oriented communities linked to an efficient and extensive transit network. This vision, as we first outlined in the 1990s, is the vision adopted by all 21 area jurisdictions in Region Forward. I'm here to support our metro system, but also to speak in opposition to the proposed fare increases and service cuts. Metro has been central to our region's economic success. It has generated billions of dollars in development and economic activity while increasing mobility and accessibility. Without Metro, our region would need 1,600 more lane miles of highways and hundreds of blocks of downtown parking. Without Metro, our city and core suburbs would be as torn apart by highways and parking lots as sadly occurred in too many other U.S. cities. With Metro, 84% of new office development in the pipeline is taking place within 1/4 mile of a station, as corporate leaders increasingly seek out these locations. With Metro, millennials, downsizing empty nesters, and others are flocking to our walkable transit-oriented centers, of which we have more than any other region in the country. With Metro, we make possible the compact land forms that maximize walking, cycling, and transit trips while minimizing vehicle trips. Every person who lives and works in a transit-oriented community represents a regional transportation solution. Tysons and White Flint are booming because of Metro. This is why we so strongly support Metro's rehabilitation programs and Metro Momentum, beginning with the investment in 8-car trains and downtown station capacity. It is also why we and the 80% of those you polled support increasing state and local investment to meet Metro's full operating budget shortfall rather than including $46 million in fare increases and service cuts. When we see $46 million, we think about the prices of interchanges nowadays, and we have a clear choice to invest in what we already have, maintain, rehabilitate, and better utilize it. We understand the local pressures on our budgets, but if local governments can't do it all, then states need to do more. We need to ask Congress to fix the transit benefit. And in the end, let's remember we are all Metro, and we do need the leadership of our elected officials, all of them, to support this system. Thank you.
Thank you. It's Terry Clower, to be followed by Rich Bradley.
Good afternoon. My name is Terry Clower. I am the Deputy Director Designate of the Center for Regional Analysis at the University. I am recently moved to this area from North Texas, where I ran a research center that job was to examine the economic effect of transportation systems as part of our portfolio. As you're aware, the D.C. economy is currently facing challenges, largely due to reductions in federal procurement and employment. The effect is painfully obvious. Our job growth in this region, we are now being beat by Detroit in terms of job growth. Clearly, what we have seen is a shift in job growth in this area also toward retail, leisure, and hospitality, which is a step down from what we're normally used to seeing. What we are needing to do is to be more competitive on a regional, national, global basis to diversify our economy. Based on studying the connection between transit systems and economic development for almost 20 years, in my judgment, there is no region in this country that relies more on its transit system to promote economic development. And certainly, as just been stated, you have transit-oriented development and neighborhood effects. But what I want to talk to you today about is more about the broader economic effects. Transit systems allow employers to expand their labor shed. They can find the skill sets and a more competitive labor market. This in turn allows those companies to be more competitive in the regional, national, global marketplace. Decisions that you might make that would reduce services and or increase fares that might push certain commuters back on the roadway is going to affect that competitiveness. Now, certainly, as an economist, I understand the budget issue. But your supporting jurisdiction might receive short-term fiscal gain from reductions that you might do. I believe it could put at risk longer-term economic opportunities. Therefore, I suggest you consider these broader economic challenges in your situation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carr. Mr. Bradley, followed by Jim Dinegar.
Good afternoon. I'm Rich Bradley, the Executive Director of the Downtown Improvement District. Affordable, efficient public transit has been a critical component in the economic success of the downtown, the city, and the region. Coming to the bid, we had over $15 billion investment just in office space downtown alone. The current budget gap, in part due to the perpetual need to grapple with the escalating operating costs and stagnant ridership. And luckily, this does present a challenge, as the chairman suggested here, to look at different ways to approach it. But one solution, significantly cutting service, is the wrong way to go. The region cannot afford the major service cuts proposed to close the gap. Proposed reductions in metro rail service will do tremendous damage to the system's ability to move people and provide access to jobs. Longer wait time for more crowded trains and buses hurts residents, businesses, and decreases ridership. In particular, the proposal to eliminate late-night metro rail service is a direct threat to the growing sector of the D.C. and the region's economy. We estimate that the downtown economy now in the city is close to 24% of the city's economy. Late-night service is a critical component of the overall economy of the region. What is most concerning about these proposed service cuts is the relatively small amount of money saved. It would be a shame to see the region squander the long-term investments in transit by failing to find ways to operate the system, provide the workers and residents of this region with quality transit services. In many respects, the issue you're confronting here is the issue we'll confront in the long run. The business community, citizens, and public officials need to work with you to find some means of dedicated regional funding to help us sustain our services and our capital. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryson. Mr. Dinegar.
Board, I'm Tim Dinegar. I'm president of the Greater Washington Board. Nice back at the headquarters down the block. No prize. Wizards will be in the playoffs. Please say that again. Don't hear it all. And the Capitals will be in the playoffs. The Washington Nationals are the odds-on favorite to win the World Series. Do you understand what's going on in the Greater Washington region in terms of growth? They actually self-imposed high wage. Federal government isn't cutting everybody. They're actually looking for more of the people to come. We're looking for more and more of the people that we need to fill the qualified jobs. And there's a quality of life that Metro helps. Get people to work on time, get people safe. It is really the crown of the region. So before we negotiate against ourselves, before we refuse to go back to the jurisdiction, say let's impose a fare hike, let's cut the service. I'd actually say buck up. I'd say that we shouldn't be negotiating against ourselves. We take the case, go back to the jurisdiction, show them how we really are the economic engine of Greater Washington. Well, I would hold off on the fare increases, the service cuts, go make the case back to the jurisdiction.
Thank you. Next is Maris Leos and then Phil Posner. To bring Maris a mic.
I am a writer of Metro Access. I know you guys get Metro is having some financial decisions they have to make. I'm just here asking you on behalf of me and anybody who's disabled, that you would please consider, if you have to do something, do not cut service. If you have to do increases, which is really hard for people on fixed income, but if you have to do increases, I ask that you would consider lowering the multiplier for retroactive instead of it being twice, make it once. Because people who use Metro Access, it's their primary way to get around, their primary way to get to the doctor, their primary way to get to work, their primary way to get to the doctor. So if you have to cut things, it's not good because it's their primary way. So I'm just asking you, if you have to consider doing something, lower the multiplier, do not cut routes, and do not make it harder for disabled people to get around where they need to get to. Thank you.
Thank you, Marissa. Bill Posner, followed by Denise Rush.
Good afternoon. I'm a little early this month. It's just me. Nothing to do with the other talk later. Person with disabilities who ride fixed routes and cross their disabilities do not permit them to drive will be adversely affected by any fare increase. These individuals are reliant on public transit for all or nearly all of their activities to be hard hit if fares are increased again or any surcharges are assessed. These individuals are low and moderate income people in many cases. Their cost burden is higher because they have to live near transit and housing near transit, especially on routes when there are frequent services is more expensive. Also, the cost of transportation can mount if they have to use it for everything that they do. They're basically the elderly, disabled, living on SSDI, Social Security, and fixed income. I'll repeat what Marissa said, and that is anything you do to increase fares on bus and rail going to affect Metro Access twice. It's two times. If you do have to increase those fares, please protect Metro Access because these are the people that are most in need financially. You can make a revenue neutral adjustment to the multiplier, or you can use a surcharge type of temporary increase as was done 3 years ago. The other thing that I like to point out is if you reduce bus routes, that also impacts Metro Access because you will be taking away service night and weekend from the people that use Metro Access, keeping away from churches, keeping away from shops. So please consider that if you have to go the route of entry. I'm hoping that you won't do that. If there are changes in headways on the rail, please take that as an opportunity to increase safety by having longer dwell time. Elderly and disabled people take longer to get on and off the train. It would be nice if there were a slightly longer dwell time to get them to get on the station. And one last thing to be positive, Mr. Reichel will hate me for suggesting this, is you could leave the DN's position open this year and save some salary. I'm glad he's still smiling.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. Denise Rush, followed by Barbara Millville.
Good afternoon. I am a daily Metro Access user, and I've been using the service for 16 years. An increase would really affect the income that people are on fixed income. They can't afford to take their rides now. An increase would really affect them. It will be double. So if you have, you need to change the multiplier to one time and not double the fare. You're having a reduction in ridership because people, especially Metro Access, are afraid to use the fixed route because how are we going to get outcomes if there's a problem? So please be considerate and have a conscience and remember the effort. We want to get around and we primarily use systems. So please consider us when you change the game or change the service, because it will definitely really affect us. Thank you.
Thank you. Barbara Millville, followed by Rob Whitfield.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your past support. And I just wanted to let you know that I'm the president of the National Capital Citizens with Low Vision. And there has been a lot of talk in our low vision community. The partially sighted community is very concerned about the safety within the rail system. And there is a lot of fear about that. And there's talk that they will, instead of using the rail, they will use the more costly metro access. We strongly recommend that the Metro Board consider in their 2016 operating budget to put focus on the lighting maintenance. We need to have all the lights on that are in the system. And I would also recommend that for the capital improvement plan, that you continue the great work that you started with the mezzanines and move on to the platform. That will really help encourage people to use bus rail. Thank you again for your support.
Thank you, Mr. Melville. Rob Whitfield, followed by Bill Orleans.
Mr. Chairman, board members, I'm Rob Whitfield with the Fairfax County Taxpayers Alliance. Our board did not meet this month, so these are not my clear, sure reflection. I've been attending WMATA board meetings since 2011. One of the first board meetings I went to was November 3rd, 2011, at which the Finance Committee was shown that the capital replacement costs for the original 103-mile metro rail system by 2020 was $13.3 billion, of which it was reported that they had not identified funds for $6.5 billion. Over the following 3 years, I talked to Carol Kissel several times to ask about progress on approaching the funding of the $6.5 billion gap. The final time was in early April 2014, 1 week before she resigned, and I asked again, what progress, and she said, none. So I guess the question for the board is, when are you going to take steps, and what steps? Well, I'll make a simple proposal that you need a capital reserve replacement fund for which you'll have to surcharge riders 50 cents a ride up to 5 miles, and over 5 miles, $1 a ride. Put that into a lockbox fund to help the riders share towards the capital replacement costs for the new rail cars and so on. I've noted that you are spending $184 million for a new fare card system. That seems extremely lavish in this time of financial austerity. I don't know if it was cost-benefit justified, but I certainly intend to find out more about that program, and I don't even see it in the budget allocations for this year. The Series 7000 production rail cars were supposed to have been delivered starting last summer. I have asked repeatedly in the last 6 months of various officials, most recently about an hour ago. Nobody seems to know when the decisions are going to be made to complete the production car delivery. And so I would ask that you raise the fares to reflect capital cost problems.
Thank you. So Bill Orleans, followed by Edgar Aranda.
I suppose the customer service is invited to ask questions I was unable to ask at that committee at this committee meeting. I will return to them, but I see the topic at this meeting.
Pull the mic down.
I'll say that I oppose any service reductions. I'm in favor of service expansion. And you all ought to, too, and you ought not allow there to be service reductions. And those of you who vote in your respective jurisdictions' budgets, when Metro sends you a bill, you should honor that bill and agree to raise your own necessary allocation to Metro so that service is not cut but can be expanded. Some of the fares might, I might think, could be tweaked. But generally speaking, I oppose fare increase. What I do favor is this idea that we should hit our those who subsidize Metro, the surrounding jurisdictions, and the feds with a bill. And if they fail to honor the bill that we send them, we should shame them. Returning to the questions I was unable to ask at earlier in the day, I do believe transparency. I welcome this public comment. I had no way of knowing it was occurring. This is the first committee meeting in at least 2 years that there's been public comment allowed. When the board, in its desire to achieve transparency with the public 3 years ago, said that there would henceforth be the opportunity for the public to comment at committee meetings, it occurred one time and not since. When I spoke at a board meeting several months ago and asked for a specific number of how many meetings since that resolution occurred 3 years ago did the board allow in any of its committee meetings the public to comment, no one responded to me, board or staff. I'm suggesting a new metric for vital signs. I would like to know the availability monthly and quarterly and annually of the restrooms. The next time a station attendant tells me that the customer restroom is closed and I may not use the employee restroom, I'm going to be depositing whatever it is I have to deposit in front of the station attendant booth. There is...
Thank you, Mr. Arlene.
Well, wait a minute. I have one more thing from this morning. Bear with me just a second here. There is a factor at terminus stations where incoming trains to the terminus have to linger outside the station for some reason for several minutes. Twice this week, as I was approaching New Carrollton Station, my orange train had to wait roughly 5 minutes for one of the two trains on the platform to depart the station. The other one was stationary. I twice this week lost a half hour having to wait for one more bus to arrive. Where do I send that bill? Where do I get recompense for that hour
this
week?
Thank you, Mr. Orleans. Your time has expired.
Well, in more ways than one. Thanks.
Mr. Aranda.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair and members of the committee. It's not going to take more than 3 minutes. I am the chair of the Virginia Coalition of Latino Organizations. Most of our members are from Virginia. They are from Virginia. I am here because we are very concerned about the raise of the fares and also the cut of hours of the service of the metro. Many Latinos, of course, they already are well off, but there are many others who don't have papers and they're struggling and they really are making very low income, and this kind of increase will impact them negatively. And also, cutting the hours will be very bad because while many people use the metro to go to parties and many other things, our community is working during the nights in restaurants, doing many other things. And cutting that will be really devastating because it is no news for many people that in Virginia, people without proper documentation cannot have a driver license. If you don't have driver license, you cannot drive a car safely. So while we have that law, or we don't have that law in Virginia, the metro is a need. It's something that we use it, and we really appreciate that. I am asking you, please consider that, because we need that. It is a need, on top of what all the colleagues already said. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Carmen Leon, and then Adriana Bonilla.
My name is Carmen Leon. I'm retired, and I volunteer at a community center.
Thank you. Adriana Bonilla and then Lois Offe. Thank you. Lois Athe and then Brandon Cox.
Good afternoon. Thank you for listening to the public. It's very important to hear what the average person thinks about Metro. I've been riding Metro since the 70s. I'm a senior citizen. I work with a community group in Arlington, Bugatta, and many of the people we work with are immigrants. They can't afford Metro now, so I think raising fares would be very difficult for them. Secondly, I know several senior citizens, couples, who go back and forth on Metro to their doctor's appointments, and they've told me over the past year they now take a taxi because it's cheaper for the couple to go by taxi than take Metro. That's a sad comment on Metro. Also, one of our programs is with low-income youth, and they used to come to field activities from Arlington to D.C., but it's very expensive to travel on Metro. There's no special rate group fares for community groups, and I think that's something, if you do increase service, increase fares, you should take into account the needs of special groups, such as a youth group that tries to travel, and it's going to be prohibited with the increase in fares. Finally, I think another issue is recruiting Latinos for positions at Metro, especially bus drivers. I know this is a key issue. Many Latinos work in janitorial and low-wage jobs, but there's some who are quite educated, the young people especially, in the system, and they should be recruited for the bus driver positions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Brandon Cox and then Pedro Pablo.
Good afternoon. My name is Brandon Cox, Senior Director of Rehab and Education Services and a certified O&M specialist with the Columbia Lighthouse for the Blind. I'm here today to encourage WMATA to continue its commitment to accessibility for people with disability. CLB partners closely with the Department of Access Services to provide travel training for people with visual impairments and the implementation of the Click and Go DC Metro Wayfinding Project in the Metro system. Over the years, CLB has been awarded significant funding for a travel training program through New Freedom, the FDA, and the TPB. This includes $350,000 by the end of 2015 that has been awarded to demonstrate the use of Click and Go Wayfinding Map in the system through New Freedom, the Enhanced Mobility Program. The goals of these services are to increase system accessibility and encourage individuals with disabilities to become less dependent on Metro access and use the fixed route, bus, and rail system. I have three recommendations. First, continue funding travel training and orientation mobility services through the Department of Access Services. Second, continue work to ensure that the WMATA web-based information is accessible and 508 compliant. And I commend Christian Blake for his work on this. Number three, determine a path forward for funding and the implementation of Click and Go Wayfinding Map system-wide. Click and Go virtual tours are now available in 11 stations and accessible through a website, iPhone application, and interactive voice response system. Stakeholder groups have been conducted by WMATA, and outcomes were extremely favorable. In 2015, after final WMATA approval, CLB will move forward with implementation of iBeacons and low-vision map in five major stations that will demonstrate the Click and Go system's ability to establish indoor real-time location and wayfinding information for travelers with disabilities, foreign languages, and tourists. Features will include identification of landmarks, elevators, escalators, and positions where it is safe to board the train. We are also conducting research for emergency egress that for all travelers when they may encounter emergency situations where visibility is not clear. By the end of 2015, we will have invested $350,000 of CLB funds through a grant. And at this point, we have not been able to achieve a grant match with Metro due to the new policies that the board has established for matching grants and partnerships. We've requested a $50,000 match this year for a $250,000 program. We're not able to accomplish it due to time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Pedro Pablo and then Allison Saunders. Allison Saunders. Commissioner Marlin.
President of Hillcrest Board of Governors. The V5 line of the bus that I take, the Metro, travel in the morning to and from my office. Metro and Metro bus are the way many people in our community and in our state commute. A fare hike would challenge those who are under and unemployed from using transportation meant for all. Cutting service in neighborhoods in Southeast limits access to jobs and other opportunities across the river. Please reconsider canceling the service to the V5 and 34 bus. As it is the only means for those that travel from Fairfax Village, Anacostia, and points between to commute to their jobs at the Navy Yard and to the major connection hub at the Front Plaza. Also, please consider canceling service on the 5A service to Dulles, as the only way workers can commute to Dulles without a car. In my job, I have an opportunity, if there's an emergency, to fly specially. If you don't have then we take the 5A to save the government money. And if it's canceled, then we take the bus. I also want to point out for this afternoon that the elected form to submit comments on was unavailable as of 11:55, but my boss thought it was important enough for me to attend this meeting in person. Thank you.
Thank you. Next speaker.
Good afternoon. First, I'd like to say, who is a designated person within the Metro system to notify communities of changes in their bus lines? This is the third time that I've had to face this challenge of the 30 bus lines being altered in my community. I am Commissioner Robin Marlin. I'm chair of ANC 7B. I'm also the single district commissioner for where these changes are about to take place. And speaking of the total elimination of the V5 bus, which services 700-plus residents in the Fairfax Village community east of the river, and also the 34 bus that also services my constituents along the Naylor Road corridor on Pennsylvania Avenue. In April, I walked with six constituents, two of whom are here in the audience, to Jim Hamry, who promised us, or I should say left us with the impression that our bus system would be left alone. And here I appear with you, not a year has passed, but now you're proposing to make further cuts and changes to our bus system. I appear before the board in November when Councilmember Bowser was the D.C. representative. And now I'm asking Mr. Evans to please work with my community to make sure that we experience no more further bus cuts or alterations to our bus line. We'll also promise that bus stops wouldn't be removed. Constituents called out ANC and reported that bus stops were removed along Branch Avenue. This is the Hillcrest community. I realize the bus lines for the 30 line have been an issue for the drivers. They feel like it's a long distance to drive a bus from one end of the city to the other. But please, don't have us scrambling around to try to catch buses. They've already altered our buses last year. We don't need any further cuts. Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. And our last speaker, Anthony Stevens.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for the opportunity to take this couple of minutes to share with you a very important issue, which you heard earlier. And it's very significant, not just for all Metro riders, but particularly for those in our area who are low vision. I am Tony Stevens. I manage public policy and advocacy for National Issues for the Blind in Alexandria. Ride down every day on the Rush Plus from Greenbelt. Love that extension. Thank you. But in terms to low vision, the capital improvements that have been made for lighting in the Metro system have made critical advancements for those in our community with low vision. Many may think that just because a person is blind, they see nothing, when in fact most people in our country who are blind, as some will say legally, are low vision. For them, lighting is crucial. The advancements has been made just a short walk down here. You can walk down the Judiciary Square and see some of that yourself. I highly recommend it, avoiding the ice capade today at the Brockton Center. But in terms of seeing the success there, it's a model that can be replicated. Our hope is that as the mezzanines get completed, then the work can continue on in the platforms. I know this is a project that helps all Metro riders, but particularly those who are trying to be as independent as they can in the community. It's getting folks off Metro access, allowing them to be able to get to work, and it's a system that makes it safer for everybody. So having shared that, I hope that you will very much consider in the capital improvements, continuing the work that's been done on the lighting, and as well in the operations, making sure that the commitments that have been made and the improvements are sustained through continued maintenance through operations. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you all of you for really making the case that we all have to think through as we face the budget issues that are before us. I'm going to ask the staff for a brief presentation on the work that's been done since our last meeting. I also would like to interrupt for 1 second and ask for a motion to approve the minutes from our prior meeting.
So moved.
Is there a second? Second, all in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Thank you. And Mr. Bulger, I had also asked with respect to the subsidy to bring us, the transit benefit to bring us up to date on what's happening there.
Well, good news. This, by way of background, Mr. Chairman and members of the board, Congress increased the federal transit benefit to $250 a month at the end of the lame duck session of Congress last December for a whole whopping 10 days, and then on January 1st, the transit benefit reverted back to its previous amount of $130 a month. As Chairman mentioned, and the Metro staff have done some great analysis, what we're finding is that many of our riders run out of transit benefits about mid-month and decide to either use monies that's already been taxed or to reload their smart cards or to not take our trains and buses, but mostly our trains. So tomorrow, Congressman Peter King from Long Island will be introducing a new bill to restore the transit benefit to parity with the parking benefit, and we will have equal amount of Republican support as well as Democratic support as original co-sponsors. So we hope to be able to move this bill in the new Congress and move it quickly, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Thank you. And WMATA supported that bill at the end of last year, and I assume we'll be supporting it again. It's very important to our riders. Mr. Yes. Mr. Boney.
Thank you. I don't know if I just turned it on or
off.
You're on. I just wanted to thank Mr. Bulger for his update on that, and I think that in the spirit of leaving no stone unturned, I think the gentlemen are gone, some of them who spoke earlier representing the business community and a good number of the employers in our region. But in that same spirit, I know that not all employers offer transit benefits to their employees or offer any commuter benefits. But to the extent that that we might be able to have a dialogue with those who are represented here from the downtown bid and from the Board of Trade, et cetera, I think that would be another important dialogue to open. I think that our own data has shown how very price sensitive our customers are and how very much they appreciate having some assistance on their commute benefits. And it actually makes a huge difference even on, you know, when it comes down to a single trip about how they decide to travel, whether or not they have some assistance for that travel. And I do think that I would call full-throated support for Metro was very gratifying. I'd love to also get their assistance in maybe engaging with their own members about those employee commute benefits. Thank you.
Mr. Rico, can you and Dennis bring us up to date on where we are in the budget process and what we've been doing since the last two special meetings?
Thank you. The staff certainly appreciates the 18 people that have come forth today to take their time to make comments. And Lynn Bowersox is going to begin the discussion this afternoon with further comments and information that we've received from the public. So, Lynn.
Thank you, Mr. Rico, Mr. Chairman. As we heard from the riders, from the community-based organizations, and from the business community this morning, consistent with that, we've heard through our own research some of the same themes, and we just want to round out the board's understanding today of what our customers are telling us. Let me just start with a piece of research that we did in December where we talked with about 2,000 of our riders. 31% were from Maryland, 40% from Virginia, the remainder from the district. And what we heard clearly from those riders was that the large majority, more than 80%, oppose rail headway changes during the rush hour. They were slightly less opposed to reductions in the midday and services after midnight, but overall they would prefer not to see service cuts. Bus customers were more supportive of reducing or eliminating underperforming bus services than they were eliminating a little bit of service from all routes, which was one of the alternatives in the draft. customers further said that they would, by an overwhelming number, 92%, support cracking down on fare evasion if it, in fact, netted revenue that was important to closing the budget gap. When we asked our customers, what ideas do you have for closing the budget, for balancing the budget, no one idea got 10% or more of the customer's reaction or responses, but we did have a few that offered some thoughtful responses that I thought were worth sharing, in some cases verbatim. The number one idea that was suggested by customers was around achievements through sustainability, cost reductions through sustainability, and specifically they mentioned energy-efficient light fixtures, alternative fuels, and in the case of one customer, eliminating escalators or at least stopping the operation of escalators on weekends and having people walk as they do in other systems. The second suggestion regarding employee pay was to institute a pay freeze, indicating in some instances among riders that they have suffered pay freezes and aren't able to afford higher fares. In the third instance, the suggestions were to look inside our organization, reduce management jobs that are unnecessary or redundant, and automate processes where we could, or to use fewer employees in stations that were not frequented by tourists. And in the instance where we talked about advertising revenues, our customers said that we ought to try to increase marketing and resource development efforts to shift some of the burden from customers to willing sponsors and to increase advertising in the metro system, especially aboard trains themselves. And then increasing reliability was a theme that came up, and basically the theme from those customers was that better scheduling, more frequency, a better reliability of the service with improvements to the system would, in fact, increase ridership and result in more revenue. Then we went more recently to our community-based organizations, 46 of which took the time to respond, and asked them very similar questions about balancing the budget. And like you heard from some folks this morning, those organizations were concerned about the impacts on low-income, disabled seniors, and minority riders, who they overwhelmingly said, again, by more than 80%. In fact, Virginia was the strongest, 88%, Maryland, 78%, that they oppose the increase of fares and the reduction of service. and in fact all said that they thought jurisdictional support should be increased as an alternative. When asked about fare evasion, also 84% said they thought that that would be a worthwhile effort in order to help balance the budget. And in terms of real-time research results, as of 9:15 this morning, and I did hear the comment about the lack of availability at one point in time of the electronic form, and we'll look into that. But as of 9 o'clock this morning, since we posted the draft docket on Monday online, we had 279 recommendations come from 148 people who looked at the draft docket. And of those, the top three comments that we received, number one, opposing the fare change, more heavily from Maryland and Virginia than from the district residents who made those recommendations. Number two, don't change bus service in the district. And number three, improve quality to increase ridership. With that, I'm going to turn it over to Dennis to talk about topics from the previous work session.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of topics from the previous work session, there were three items, pension, hedging, and the fare implementation schedule that were issues that staff was asked to look into. And prior to today, staff provided the board with additional information on each of those topics. But I would like to take some time at this point to quickly summarize the key points from those additional information provided to the board. On pensions, Metro has five employee pension plans, of which Local 689 is the largest plan. Metro's plans have funded ratios of around 70%, which is good, but not great. But more importantly, the projected pension contributions for WMATA going to Local 689 will see a material reduction in the future, again, based purely on actuarial projections. This is due to a couple of factors, one of which obviously is the rebound in the capital markets, but also from the recent cost sharing with employees with respect to pension contribution. So if these projections hold, the future reductions in these contributions obviously will offer Metro an opportunity to address other key budget issues, including the open liability, which this board has dealt with over the last few years. On fuel hedging, we noted, if you recall, during the budget work session that budget stability is critical not just to Metro, but to Metro's stakeholders, both the jurisdictions as well as the customers. And this is particularly so given the long lead time for budget adjustments or for fare adjustments. Accordingly, Metro hedges, or in other words, locks in the price for its commodity, including fuel, in order to achieve and maintain that stability. And indeed, as we've been advised by the General Counsel or Acting General Counsel, Metro is prohibited from using hedging as an investment strategy and may only enter into such instruments as an insurance policy, which, again, is how Metro has utilized that. And finally, with respect to fare implementation timeline, Metro used the 90-day timeline over the last two cycles and based on that was able to successfully roll out those adjustments without error and with broad communication with our customers. The 90-day timeline is based on three critical part items, each of which takes approximately 4 weeks. Creating and verifying the new data source, creating and testing and verifying individual files, over 200 files in this case or in each case, and then production, fabrication, and distribution of those files across the network. There are quality control risks associated with shortening these three steps, which is why staff continues to recommend maintaining the current timeline. I will pause at this juncture to ask whether the committee members have additional questions on these topics.
Dennis, let me just thank you for the most extensive analysis that as long as I've been on this board, we've received regarding all of our pension trustee activities. Just let me say that again. This is the most extensive information I've ever received about where we are on our pensions. One question that I just needed to ask was, in our memo that you gave us, the most recent actuarial valuation reports for our largest pension, 689, which in the memo shows an unfunded ratio of 28%, which is pretty high, not critical. We do not have projections of future funded pension ratios. And there's another one, too, a smaller pension fund that we don't have future funded ratios. Can you just tell us why our largest pension doesn't have future funded ratios that we could know more about?
Thank you, Mr. Bolch. I don't have an answer for you on the question. Perhaps Mr. Roca may be able to provide some insight on that issue.
Dennis, I'm not sure that I can. I've been a trustee, a management trustee on that union. I think it's something we could ask our actuary to prepare for us as part of our process on an annual basis.
Well, I noticed that in Dennis's memo that I urge you all to read it in our board correspondence that we hopefully will get in the future. Quarterly pension plan reports, fund valuations, assets performance, and funded ratios, and the results of annual audits, actuarial valuation of each plan annually. I think the board needs to see this information, not to be surprised about investments that may not have, you know, worked as well as they should have, although the investment portfolio looks pretty solid, robust. Luckily, the markets are up. So I urge, thank you, Dennis, for committing to those reports, and Jack, as we go forward. But I would like you to ask our largest pension, you know, trustees, and if you're a trustee, Jack, I'm going to ask you to directly, please give us the funding ratios that the other pension funds have produced.
We'll ask for that information.
Thank you.
And we're committed to giving you quarterly reports on all five.
I look forward to seeing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the follow-on information on pensions was very helpful. The bad news was it doesn't look like it's helpful in the coming fiscal year. The contribution is going up for actuarial reasons, even though there are contributions. There's definitely a window opening up over the next 4 or 5 years. It's something we really should be looking at closely as we look towards a longer-term sustainability, so where that delta might go. But it was not a place we could find help this time. Hedging didn't also seem to be a place where we could find too much help, although obviously our unhedged commodity purchases should do very well in the next year, but the ones that have given us stability, unfortunately, it's stability at last year's prices. If prices had gone up, we'd feel good. Prices went down. It's one of those rare occasions we have to feel bad. But are there other issues that the board felt were necessary coming off the work sessions and looking at the budget? Yes, Dragon.
I don't know how essential it is, but I'd sent a memo around after you and I talked, Mr. Chairman, actually, about a provision that had passed maybe in 2011 that would allow station-specific surcharges. I know that one of the issues, I don't expect it to necessarily raise a lot of money, but we kind of capped it at a particular amount. We limited it to 2 stations per jurisdiction. And as a contribution to the capital budget, I don't know why we would need to necessarily constrain ourselves that way. And I do know that Metro riders like to know where their money is going, and that if you had a surcharge at a station that was paying for a very specific improvement, you know, you could watch the progress of that improvement. And I think people have a little bit more confidence if they can see what the money is going for. And I think in this, in this moment where we're talking about, you know, potentially facing some hard choices, I think that's an option we might want to avail ourselves of. And I, My intention in sending that out was that we would get it on the docket, and I don't see that it happened.
I don't think it did, but we asked the staff to be prepared if you want to offer an amendment to the docket that should be considered.
Yes, please.
Mr. Chairman, that was the direction provided to staff, and in discussion of the draft docket, we are looking for an opportunity to make that introduction.
Mr. Goldman.
Yes.
I mean, that is one of the decisions we have to come out of this meeting with, which is, will the docket go forward for board consideration in 2 weeks, recognizing it is not something we really want to do. It's something that at the end of 2 weeks we may have to have in our pocket as we go forward with the budget. So at this point, if there are no further questions about the budget, I think it's open to, if there is such a motion, to entertain the docket and amendments to the docket. I would move that the docket be recommended to the board.
For clarification, if there are items that we want to ensure that they're on the docket, do we offer those now or after the motion is made or when?
After the motion.
Okay.
After we put the put the docket before us, it'll be open for amendment. Second. Been moved and seconded, so that's on the table for discussion and amendment. Mr. Evans.
Okay, I'll go first. Marilyn would like to make some suggested changes, move some changes to the docket as opposed to the bus routes that have been scheduled. So I don't know how you want to proceed, Mr. Chairman. I've distributed a copy of the proposed amendment both to yourself, Chair, as well as to the acting general manager for review. So I don't know if you want me to just refer to it as Marilyn's proposed changes to the docket and move it at this point in time for a second.
Just a question. What is it? Since only two people have it, none of the rest of us.
I have some other. Some additional copies.
Why don't you distribute them?
Pass around.
These are, as I understand it, all changes to routes and services in Maryland.
That's correct.
Yes, and there's both additions and deletions.
No, I was waiting for a second.
I'll second that.
To just describe it. So essentially, Maryland, the Department of Transportation, engaged in a round of consultation both within its organization, the MTA that provides commuter bus service from the suburbs into the city, as well as with Prince George's County and Montgomery County, to review the docket of bus routes changes when it became available late last week or beginning of this week. And they've come forward with changes, really, to deletion of six bus route changes, which they don't believe should be on the docket. Even when those changes were they accepted to be for the docket, there would still be over $3 million in annualized savings proposed on Maryland bus routes. I'll just identify the six routes where we would propose to delete them from the docket. Two have to do with W-15 and W-19 in Prince George's County because they had already been the subject of public hearing and dockets and voted on by the board last month. There's a C-12, which is a bus route through Hillcrest Heights, and the problem with that is that the recommended change was to eliminate Saturday service. Unfortunately, the bus route, which is the Prince George's County local service, does not operate on weekends today, so that would be a total elimination of service. So we don't think that should be on the docket. There's the J-5, which is a bus route connecting Twin Brook with Silver Spring. Unfortunately, if you eliminated this, there'd be no single seat or same bus route that would go between those two endpoints. So we don't think that that's a reason to put this bus on the bus route on the docket, since it would eliminate all bus service on that route. Next, the V-14 in District Heights. Again, the proposal is to put it on the docket to eliminate Sunday service. Unfortunately, the Prince George's County bus does not offer weekend service. And finally, Z-6 is a route from involving Calverton in which there is a proposal to eliminate late-night service. This is the only bus route between Calverton and Burtonsville, and since it provides the only service between those points, again, the parties that be in Prince George's County as well as the state don't feel that that should be on the docket. So we would move to have those six routes stricken from the docket. There are some minor additions as well on changes that are also part of it, but those are the six routes that we would propose to have eliminated from the docket.
That's a motion and a second. Is there a discussion of that amendment?
So what is the cost savings, Mr. Goldman, of deleting these? And some of them were repetitive, but the ones that are not, what's the cost savings estimate for budget purposes?
I do not know the total cost savings. As I said in introducing it, the MDOT calculation, Maryland Department of Transportation calculation, is that the docket would still include over $3 million in annualized savings from bus routes in Maryland, which I think is fairly substantial since the total savings, I believe, on the docket of low productivity bus cuts would be $10 million. So Maryland would still be in the mix for potentially $3 million in savings resulting from these budget cuts that are left on the docket.
Mr. Chairman, I just mentioned, you know, the board can take the action. So since we just received this in the last couple hours from Mr. Goldman, we're certainly going to evaluate it as quickly as we can and certainly give any comments back to the board during the next 2 weeks, which we're deliberating these actions.
So that as we move forward on this two-track process, one track being whether we can actually close the gap with other measures, right, the other being keeping alive the need to have to use service cuts, you would provide us with a repriced docket reflecting these changes?
The difficulty with the amendment that's proposed is that if to the extent that the board adopts a docket today, it may or may not be consistent with the original goal of the $46 million. And so
that's my point. We are not adopting it today. We are sending it to the board. But before the board would act on it in 2 weeks, we would need to know if, in fact, it achieves the financial savings that would be needed if we had to go that route.
My assumption
is preference would be to go another route. But if we had to use service cuts or fare increases to close our gap, we need to know what would be produced.
My assumption is the discussion today will lead to some further consideration and evaluation, and will be, and that we won't finalize the docket until the actual board meeting
itself. That's correct. Yeah. But we should perhaps start with a base of what the jurisdictions would offer. Hopefully, the jurisdictions might also be offering some level of additional support that might be affordable together with other actions to get us to a gap closing. Ms. Hines.
Thank you, Mr. Downey. On behalf of my jurisdiction, I would like to request a change, and it's a swap out, and effectively I think puts a little bit more money on the table. And that would be that we would take over the 3A Lee Highway line from East Falls Church to Roslyn, bring that into the Arlington bus. And the thing we would like to remove from the docket is any service changes along Columbia Pike at this point in time.
A very sensitive place.
A very sensitive place for us, and we think we can deliver the 3A service equally, if not with a little more frequency than WMATA is doing it.
And still pending is the Maryland motion, but are there other items to discuss at this point?
We'll come back to that.
Yes, Councilman.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Chair, as you know, I do not support reduction of service for fare increases to any of the less than the district companies. Nor do I support fare increases for reduction of service to the rail, because regardless of the state of our country, going down that road is terrible. As such, I will vote. So what I'm going to do is move an amendment to the docket to disprove vote in favor, to disprove the section of the docket that includes service reduction or fare increases to the rail system and bus.
I would read that to be a recommendation to the board that when they act on this, it should be disapproved.
Right.
Again, leaving open the option that we find other alternative ways to close our gap, in which case it would be moot, or if not, this is not the way you would go to close it, which would put us back in having to find other things that might be even more arduous. But I think you're, in effect, saying, as several of us are, willingness to come to the table to see if we can come up with a solution that works for all of us. But clearly that your position with respect to the district is this is a bad idea.
Yeah. And from the district's point of view, we will fund what we have to fund in order to avoid service reduction or fare increases in the rail. I recognize bus controls one of the districts. And that's our thank you.
Voting and Ms. Brown, did you have a
meeting where we had a short but vigorous discussion about the ability of jurisdictions to fund their own service, and that we didn't have to necessarily slide down to the lowest common denominator. I was, somewhat rebuked about that, and then and because it showed up on Twitter, I got a very helpful reference from somebody else who sent me an example from an article in 2006. About Metro officials agreeing to extend the Yellow Line from the District of Fort Totten and increase service on the Red Line from Grosvenor to Shady Grove, with those things being paid for by the jurisdictions that benefited from the service. So I don't understand why, if the district is willing to pay for the service to protect its residents from those fare increases or service cuts, and other jurisdictions might be willing to do it too, why they couldn't. So I'd just like to raise that again. Our region is not equally transit served. Our populations are not equally dependent on transit. And if the jurisdictions have the means and the political will, I don't think it actually hurts the rest of the system and the rest of the jurisdictions to be able to see that demonstrated. If it puts undue pressure on those other jurisdictions, I think that's too bad.
Thank you. I just wanted to offer a couple of comments on the docket to help aid in transparency, if I may. The first is in the introduction where it's providing information about the budget gap. It correctly points out that the general manager proposed a budget that was a 4% increase, but I don't think provides the full amount of the context regarding the increase in jurisdictional contributions that would be close to 13% or the decrease in revenues. And I would just request staff provide the full amount of the information in order to give better perspective to the readers. Another suggestion is for both, actually I think for all of the items on the docket, I think it would be helpful to those who attend the meetings and those who read the docket to understand the value or the dollar amount that would be raised or reduced from the budget for each of the items. I think it would help, again, with transparency and perspective. And I would, and writers, of course, right? So that I'd request that staff add that information to the docket for all of the items. And then finally, something that I know the district has been requested for a while, and I know it won't be part of the docket, but I request staff to continue to look at it, and that's aligning service to demand on low ridership days, like the day after Thanksgiving, federal holidays, and things like that. That's all. Thank you.
Yes.
This is Gordian knot type discussion we're having. But I am going to put on for the Virginia Fairfax side some items to be eliminated from this list. And as I do it, I acknowledge that whoever brings forward a change has most likely never envisioned how that change affects the entire rider's transport. For example, whether you're leaving Clinton in Maryland and coming all the way from Virginia, it may look okay in Maryland to remove Clinton, but it may not look the same by the time it affects the rider. So what we're doing is sort of throwing dice because we're only affecting our own revenue and subsidy pieces that we think will be affected. So as I put this back in the join this thing, I think what we need to do is bring this together and really try and understand really how we're affecting the voices we've heard today, because none of us really know, other than from our where our jurisdiction is affected as a beginning rider or an ending rider, what it is. It simply means that. And it's, I say that because the most important thing that we have to do here is we have to come together, provide the necessary revenue to be able to run the system efficiently. And right now we're not in an efficient process. So I'm going to make these because we all are in the same place when it comes to revenue to provide the services that we need. And I will just echo the piece I said when I left the last time I was present here when doing the docket. Everybody keep in mind, if no one brings to the table a dedicated funding source that comes every year in order to look comprehensively at what we do, we will always be in this Gordian knot. But there are eight items from the list representing Virginia, and I would submit those for consideration on the docket, and I will identify them to you there. And as you see, the subsidy reductions that it will impact. But I will go back to my actual point here, is that we can go from Councilman Evans' position all the way over to this, any of the other positions here. We really have to find a way to be long-term, and we really have to set a marker on what day we're going to begin to start to think only long-term and not short. We may not get out of this budget with that, but I hope that that's where we're coming. So I have identified the eight locations, and we'll hope that when we come and bring this together at the time of the budget meeting, we can all be a little bit more comfortable where we need
to. Other questions? Yes. Then I want to try to wrap into an action we might take. Go ahead.
Just in terms of how we present the docket to the public, the way it's presented in the written materials that go along with it, it's presented as here's the maximum types of things that the board may do. We may do less than that, or we may do nothing. In fact, I think that this board is highly unlikely to do the maximum and also highly unlikely to do nothing. And so rather than presenting it to the public as how do you like these things, which, of course, the answer is we don't like these things, it would be more helpful to present it to the public as here is a list of possibilities. Tell us, assuming you don't like any of these things, which do you dislike least, which do you dislike most? Those are the kinds of responses that will be most helpful to the board, rather than sort of putting it in front of the public and saying, well, how do you like fare increases? How do you like service reductions? If we sort of presented it as sort of a menu of options and asked people to speak to one versus the other rather than telling us how much they like the whole.
So we have a number of suggestions as to how the docket might be modified, taking into account Maryland concerns, Arlington concerns, Fairfax concerns, and a district view that everything for the district should be stricken. We still have the issue of how we do balance the budget. We talked a couple of weeks ago about if it were $100 million additional, what we would have to do. If it was $75 million, if it was $50 million, all of those did require some degree of this pain in front of us. Still my view that there may be a number lower than 50 that can be put together without so much damage to our ridership and to others. I would like to get the assurance that we can continue to work with the staff and with your jurisdictional staff to see if we can get there. We still have to have the fallback. Trying to put together what we have here, what I would suggest would be that staff revise the docket in accordance with the various suggestions that have been put forward, but that this committee send it without recommendation to the board for action in 2 weeks if it turns out that action is necessary.
And if we can find a way to not do that, or if we can find a way to clearly constrain what we need, again, I think it's doable. It may not be beautiful. It may not in some ways be the sustainable long-term budget changes that we would like to have. But I think to get to those, we need more time. We need to engage in the process we've talked about of looking at bus routes, looking at who does what. We certainly need to be looking at what the opportunities would be if we had a longer-term dedicated funding source. But we also have to get through May. And said, I think we can continue, and I know Dennis and his staff will be ready to do this, continue to see if there is a way forward. We've had some preliminary conversations that say, well, that's interesting. We don't know what the impacts are, but I think we all look at them over the next couple of weeks. We may find there is a better way out than what we would otherwise be would be required to do. But I think as stewards of the organization and the need to have a balanced budget, we need to keep that opportunity open. Michael.
Let me align myself with your views and your earlier views. That certainly from my personal view and Merrill's point of view, I know to the extent that we can achieve some resolution without a fare increase and without very substantial service cuts, that would certainly be Merrill's preference and mine as well. And to be fair and consistent with the public statements that I've made before, at least it's Merrill's view that if the overall FY16 operating budget could be reduced in the range of $30 million, that would meet Merrill's need for its share of that $30 million, and that would meet our objectives. I mean, the only proviso I would place on that, which I've communicated with you previously, is that Merrill does have concerns with the revenue and traffic forecast for FY16 and believes that it's somewhat optimistic, and therefore, once that traffic figure is adjusted, there may be a need, since there would be a reduction in a more realistic budget from Merrill's point of view, for some greater savings above the 30% in order to reflect a more realistic traffic forecast. But the budget as presented, our target would be a reduction of $30 million in operating expenses.
Yes, yeah, still always are some uncertainties. One uncertainty that we've worried about is how will we come through fiscal 15? Later in the agenda, we get a report on that. It's a little more optimistic than it had been. But there always will be uncertainty. But again, if something in that magnitude could be made to work, and whether it's, I would argue, it's either reductions directly in the operating budget or reductions to what cash the jurisdictions would have to put forward out of their regular resources, it would be a better outcome than any of the things that are on the docket. Thoughts regarding data this time?
Mr. Chairman, I'm keenly aware that this is the last budget that I'll work on here. And so I want to make sure that, and I hear some of the language saying, you know, we just need to get through this year. But we look at 17 and we look at 18, and our regional economy, while we're stabilizing, is not going to go back to what we may have experienced earlier when the system first came in and we were living in the boom that certainly came in. My jurisdiction rode that wave better than anybody else's did. At the same time, we are a transit-dependent region, and we have different resources. And again, no more clearly on the table than the struggle we're having trying to figure out how to accept Northern Virginia Transportation Authority money, $300 million a year that's coming to Northern Virginia. We cannot figure out how to get to this agency to do what needs to be done because of old ways of doing things, because of everybody has to move in lockstep, because. And so there's a piece of me when Mr. Goning talks about, you know, maybe we need to uncouple our destinies here, that's like a sinking in the pit of my stomach. But at the same time, the need on our side of the river is very pressing to find more ways to efficiently move people. We've got very few bridges. We've got a tremendous amount of economic activity that runs across the river. and we need to find a way to work through this. So I guess I'm not going to disagree with your path forward, you know, and Arlington stands prepared to do what the most that we can. I will just say, you know, our share of the 30 or 35 million is a half a penny on my tax rate. Just to put that out there, it's a half a penny on my tax rate. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, 50 bucks a month for people. But I do want to say that when we reduce service and we increase fees, we shoot ourselves in the foot. And we've got to find a different way to have this conversation so that we can use money we have to meet needs we have and get credit for it here and not be held up because one-third or two-thirds of the parties are unwilling to or unable. Unable is a better word, not unwilling, but unable to make that same kind of commitment. So what I would like is for staff, because this agency has operated this way for a really long time. This is radical to say, let's decouple. It is. It's radical. So I would really like for staff to come back to us so we understand both the opportunities and the risks associated with choosing a slightly different path than has been chosen before in order to solve what are real problems that are playing out differently in different parts of the region.
But across the region, I thought the testimony today was very useful. The business community feels it's important to the real long-term growth of the region. Our riders feel it's important to their pocketbook and to their ability to get around. So the stakes are very high. Are very high.
And
we've got to find a solution.
The people who make those financing decisions are not all sitting here at this table. Some of us are, and some of us aren't. And that's a problem.
And that's, you know, I think in the next 2 weeks, if we can look at it, we need to go back to whoever the decision makers are and say, we've heard that something can be done. Are you going to be part of the solution? I know that Dennis and his staff will be ready to have those conversations.
Mr. Chair, for evaluation purposes, Mr. Groening has, or other jurisdictions have recommendations about surcharge on fares. I think what we need is the specifics as to which stations. Again, each jurisdiction under current policy has the option of two. So we'd like to have that information to add that to the docket if that's of interest.
Right. So if the jurisdictions could get back to the staff on that, we could adopt that as. And that's something that might go in even if we had a lesser docket without the fare increases, it is something we could contemplate if the jurisdictions and the board are comfortable with that.
Right.
Mr. Downey,
yes.
I think it would be helpful for staff to remind us of the priority order in the capital plan.
Yes.
The more we can run off of the plan we already have, whatever the top one is in each of our jurisdictions, remind us. And then we can have those conversations back home about whether we're ready to move, because I remind everybody it's not enough money to do a new station entrance or install an escalator. It's a small amount, so it would have to be combined with other things.
Mr. Chairman, may I ask a clarifying question, please, as to Ms. Hines' request of staff? With respect to the analysis that you're seeking in terms of jurisdictional investments that may or may not be equal, we would need to do an analysis to show what, if any, disparate impacts would exist to our riders regionally based on those kinds of scenarios. So assuming that you're interested in having that information for consideration at the same time, we would need a little bit more direction about what options were being considered in order to do those kinds of calculations in the 2 weeks that we have in front of us.
I guess I'll speak for myself, and others may have a different view. That's a great example of a risk, right? So what I'm saying is, as a board member, I don't understand all the risks or all the opportunities in the way that you all might. So the first thing is bring us that, and then we can decide whether this is a a place we want to walk down, and then we'll take the next step. But I think none of us understand the full range of what it could possibly mean.
Yeah, I would like to think about what the issues would be in terms of Title VI if we're running a regional system and saying rich people can have more service than other people.
The only thing I would say about that is if the pattern is similar,
jurisdictions,
the District of Columbia provides 42% of the subsidized housing units in the region on 11% of the population. So the baseline I'd like you to compare it to is not to if we didn't change any service, but if we had the uniform cuts that are being proposed across the region. So I actually think that allowing the district and parts of Arlington or whatever jurisdictions might be able to pay to avoid the cuts would actually be disproportionately beneficial to low and moderate income households. That's why I think those jurisdictions want to do it.
Thank you. So we'll do that. And we also need to do, to the chairman's point, for Title VI, not only low income, but also minority households. So it spreads a little bit differently regionally, but we'll respond to that.
Let's see if we could wrap up on this. Is committee comfortable with not taking a vote on all of these items individually, because I don't quite know how to do that, but rather to move this forward to the board with less than enthusiastic recommendation and a desire to keep working on alternative courses. So without a motion, I think we could proceed in that direction. And I certainly will ask each of you who has the ear of the relevant officials in your jurisdictions to say, please take Dennis's phone calls. Please come to the meetings. Please work together to see if we can make this happen and show a lot of flexibility. I think the outcome, given the circumstances we're in, given all the things that have happened in the last few weeks and the last few months, it would be far better for us to hold to our policies with stability in fares, quality of service, and a real effort on the part of management to bring costs down as far as possible, but recognizing not all of that can be done at all at one time and in one place, but it's the kind of goal that we have. With that, I would suggest we move on to Northern Virginia. And I would reiterate...
Mr. Downing?
Yes.
This is Jennifer, over here.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. We still have a motion on the table for the docket. Are you withdrawing the motion?
I'm asking the maker of that motion to withdraw it and just simply let this move to the board, if that's permissible under our rules and procedures.
I think you can table it, yes. But I think you may have to re-meet at the Finance Committee meeting perhaps that morning to do that. I think it has to be referred from the Finance Committee to the board.
All right. We'll find a way to do that. We could schedule a brief finance. We'll have the dockets ready for the 26th. If we need to meet first as the Finance Committee and then as the board, we'll take it in that fashion. And if that would achieve the purpose we want. No debate? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Northern Virginia, staff going to enlighten us a little bit on what these issues are, and I would just reiterate the point I made earlier. Please don't think of this as a Virginia problem. It's a metro problem. How do we get the support we need, and how do we flow it to the projects that are important to us? And I think, again, we have to work with our friends and with our colleagues towards a solution here.
All right. Good afternoon, members of the committee. The true experts are actually on the committee, so when I move forward, I hope you fill in the details from your perspective. This is one of those good news, bad news stories. Good news was there was a new revenue source created in Virginia in 2013. Significant amounts of money. We've been working we Metro staff have been working diligently with the local staff throughout the region to try and figure out exactly how to be able to apply this funding to projects that Metro had proposed. Two projects were, one, buses to be able to increase service in Virginia, and the other was a contribution to improving the Metro Rail power system in order to increase capacity and be able to accommodate the 8-car train. In July, that was approved. We've been working, got discussions, and there is a resolution attached. As Ms. Hines was indicating earlier, the struggle has been trying to figure out exactly how to approve and enact this funding because of particular restrictions within the law itself. And based on the counsel from the jurisdictions, NBTA, working with Mark Pohl here, we have a resolution that we think can work as applies to just the acquisition of the buses. And that's all that today's action is about. The $7 million would allow us to buy 9 new buses that would be applied to services in Virginia. We have worked through several processes to be able to document and reassure that those buses will stay in Virginia and be used in Virginia for Virginians to improve travel and reduce congestion. And so the action that's before you today is to amend the capital budget to allow for a reimbursable project that would allow us to go ahead and add on to our existing order of buses to provide these additional vehicles for use in services in Virginia. The buses would be ordered now. They would arrive at the end of fiscal 16 and would be put into service in fiscal 17. So they're not an operating issue that you have to deal with as part of what we've just been talking about, but for the succeeding year. We have a range of different services that could be used, and we would continue to work with the jurisdiction staff to identify exactly what services, whether it be on Richmond Highway or Columbia Pike or Leesburg Pike or Little River Turnpike or Glebe Road. Those are some of the candidate locations. So with that, we would recommend approval of the resolution, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Yeah. Thank you for the presentation, Mr. Embry, and I think the clarity that you've provided leaves us with a few other items that I think we need to look at. I think the bus option is a viable option, as we think it will work, but I think we may wish to consider the power option or others, and I think the best way to deal with it is to defer this for action today, and then come back to determine what the next action we would like to do. I think the description of how we will get to the overall budget collectively has some bearings on this, and I think it is important that we make sure we're clear where we want to be in Virginia.
I mean, we have deferred this several times, certainly with a further deferral if it's towards the good end of getting to a resolution. What I would also ask, then, if we do put this off, is that the other jurisdictions come in with their comments and their concerns and see if, when it comes back, we can't have unanimity.
Well, I think that's a very important point. While the legislative piece refers to Virginia, the process we're going through is truly everybody's process. It isn't just us. It's about how our money is defined, but they still, everyone else must be at stake.
Mr. Chairman, if I could a minute, let me see if I can crystallize this, because we do need to talk to everybody else about this. The two projects that WMATA sought funding for when the Northern Virginia Transportation Authority received this money are projects which are included in 2025. It's expansion bus service to support the priority corridor networks that are identified in our plan, and it's the traction power that's necessary to support 8-car trains on the Orange Line. And both projects were approved because they comply with the strictures upon which the legislation was passed. One of the most important features of the way the legislation was passed was that money coming to WMATA couldn't be used in a manner that left Virginia the only contributing party. So if we move forward on priority corridor network expansion together, we can use NVTA money as long as the buses stay in Virginia. That's another little piece of it. But if we move forward on traction power, and Maryland and D.C. are putting money into traction power expansion, then we may use money to help cover the traction power part of the bill. That would be Virginia, and it would be spent in Virginia. So we can all imagine ways we get there, but because of the way this legislation is written, we either need to have a credit or we need to all be putting money on the table at about the same time to achieve the same plan and policy goals. And that is where our rub has been, because what staff has proposed is a reimbursable project, which is not us moving forward together to move the priority corridor networks. Our money has to be used for expansion. It can't be used for state of good repair. That's just the rules. So that's the dilemma we find ourselves in. We need to find a way through, because whether somebody comes in and wants to do a large development next to a station where we know we need new entrances and high-speed elevators, or, you know, emergency exits that were not planned, all of that, if it's in our plan, we should be able to find a way to accept and move our agency forward. And right now, we do not seem to have a mechanism that accounts for that, that allows for that. And that's what we're seeking to find. Quite honestly, you know, we need to reach a resolution next month, or we will need to turn the money back. And I'm going to say that just as clearly as I can. This money is being closely watched by our General Assembly. They raise taxes. They want to see results. And if our agency can't figure out how to do this, then we need to give the money back and the jurisdictions will apply. And I think that would be a terrible, terrible result.
Bad precedent.
Very bad precedent. So I, you know, sorry for sounding, I spent more time on this in the last 3 weeks than I care to account for, and so have a lot of people sitting across the table from us too. But we really have to find a way through this, because it's about how anybody brings different money to the table.
Can I just ask one clarifying question? Sure. From my limited knowledge on this? Your position, the Virginia position, is this must be part of expansion.
It's the General Assembly
position. And that is, in our parlance, the Momentum 2025 program.
Yes.
That's where we have, that's where our shared plan for expansion is. And we have, for at least the current fiscal year, a $25 million commitment from each of the three jurisdictions to undertake.
That's right.
We may not have that for next year. It hasn't been renewed. We certainly are asking for that.
Right.
But within that context of 25-25-25, is this money part of the Virginia 25?
No, there's no.
But is there some way to, in effect, make it part of the Virginia 25 for this year to be matched by the other 25s?
I'm hesitating.
Yeah. No, I think it's just something to look at.
Well, it might be complicated to get there.
Everything's complicated.
I think we would not want to start thinking in that direction, mm-hmm. but I think it's important to look and understand it. But, well, the penalty for being wrong is very high,
yeah.
and that is the reason that and I assume we've gone this route because we find it to be the safest route. But it does mean that if there's another way that we can come up with other alternatives, yeah. But I think,
Mr. Downey, I'm
seeing heads way across the room saying I'm no.
Actually,
so I'm pretty comfortable.
Yeah, I think that's a no because.
Okay.
Because of the way the money is structured, and because of the fact that most of this money has to run through a rating program moving forward, I think it would be very difficult, if not impossible.
So the outcome has to be, in addition to 25, 25, 25, some way to ensure that if Virginia puts in more, it will be matched up.
I'm also being pitched, and I don't understand.
It's really complicated.
I know. But you all know the rules that the Commonwealth has imposed on the fund. You know what both the politics and the operational requirements are here. I don't understand where you're at in terms of the negotiation with the authority staff about what would get you to success. And the authority to success. So I'm kind of in the dark about where this is at loggerheads, and
so
perhaps somebody could explain what's.
Let me try.
Okay.
WMATA made the request for the money. Okay, it was a WMATA request. In order to get the money in, Virginia needs one of two things. They either need the rest of the region to be buying a comparable number of buses for the expansion of the bus network or putting a comparable amount of money in for traction power, or they need a way to a commitment that when the rest of the jurisdictions move forward to do their investment, that Virginia has prepaid. We don't have a mechanism for prepay or credit at the moment. That's a board policy decision. I hope I'm saying this correctly. I'm looking at my staff because I feel like I'm out here on the limb. Have I said this properly? Shoot. I guess, Todd, you better come and talk. I'm sorry. I did think I understood this. Yeah,
the credit piece that you're talking about was the way we thought we could work it out 6 months ago, 2 months ago, but the attorneys have said, no, you either have to have all three jurisdictions, meaning Virginia, D.C., Maryland, pay at the same time, or a commitment to pay through the annual work, so which almost means the same thing.
So it does mean money has to be on the table from the other jurisdictions.
Correct. Is this additional money above our capital commitment?
Money associated with expanding the priority corridor network with that activity, and which we don't have in 16, if I'm remembering right, Jim.
Correct.
Yeah.
Recently, we saw the priority corridor go forward, but it's been sort of bumpy over this something in Maryland.
And then Virginia. Actually, Virginia was first, but I won't rub that in. So we thought that in that general sense of it'll be equitable by the time we're finished, we thought we had met that test. But as you can hear, there's a lot of very nuanced interpretations.
I think this deserves some work over the next month.
Perhaps some different brains than mine.
It would be helpful if, even if there was a disagreement between, say, Virginia and the authority staff, that the board knew the details of the disagreement and that there were suggestions that the board might, actions that the board might take to solve those dilemmas. I want to be helpful. The district is incredibly supportive of what you're doing, but I don't know how to help. And I need a more direct ask.
Tom, we spent an hour and 20 minutes on the phone yesterday trying to figure out what to directly ask you for. And I don't know that we know the right way through. So there are negatives and positives on every solution we come up with. Go ahead, Todd.
If I may, it can make confusion more, but I'll give it a shot. As you've heard from Jim today, this money is for a particular project. And the application was for 9 buses. For Virginia to pay for those 9 buses, there needs to be a larger Ramada purchase than 9 buses. The 9 has to be Virginia's share of a total. And it gets quite complicated. And if you take, for ease of numbers, hopefully I'll get this right, 100 buses. If WMATA was buying 100 expansion buses, if WMATA was buying 100 buses, you would use federal dollars to pay for the buses. Right?
Expansion buses.
Expansion.
As we heard today, we might do over the next 6 years.
Right. Well, you would use federal dollars for 80-20 of those buses. So the local portion is 20%, 20 buses out of the 100 have to be purchased by local. Virginia's share of those local buses is 5 buses. Less than 9. Because it's less than 9, we can't move all this money here, even if we purchase 100.
And I think we need something other than buses.
And to do that, and here's the rub that the balance is asking. To do that, we need to submit an annual work plan from all three, Maryland, Virginia, to buy 100 plus expansion buses. I don't think Maryland is in a position to make that commitment, where Virginia has the money paid.
If our bus fleet plan, we heard it this morning, replaced only 100 buses across the region in a decade, this is not a viable strategy. That's not a viable
right. Outcome. Right. That's why I think it's taken us a while to come to understand the true implications of this. We still do have to, though, I think as a long-term strategy, figure out how we can accept the money. Regardless of whether it's Virginia money.
So,
but it's easier on traction.
Yeah.
It's easier on traction.
I think the discussion that we've had today here is the one that we need to have together with one, WMATA, and bring to the other jurisdiction. And if we can solve the WMATA issue about A, the request that currently exists, and how that will work out, and B, what should WMATA step back from the request, what is it that we all can agree on through all of your speech in order to make better use?
Could I say that this obviously has to, in the right context, this has to go to the JCC. It's a very plain language, conversations about what everybody would agree, for instance, that the district needs to commit to going forward as a result of this action about the bus, without a very clear understanding of the expectation of the other two jurisdictions, both Maryland and the district, very difficult to get to a solution that solves the problem. So,
and I think it's been quite some time. We hadn't quite, until today, really defined the problem.
Right. WMATA is modifying its request for 15-16 based partly upon what we've learned. And it is, you know, we need to think through the consequences of not being able to spend the 14 money, and it may be smarter for everybody to return 14 and change 15 slightly.
It's 14 year, not 14.
No, the 14 the year money. But anyway, we need to figure that out relatively quickly because MBTA is moving forward and setting its 15-16 program this month, And we'll be done, I think, by March, setting the 15-16 program. So the hearing's at the end of the month, I believe. So we need to sort this out.
Unfortunately, this could die not from lack of actions on your part, but an inability of one of the other jurisdictions being able to agree.
Which is awful sad.
Which also ties into where the other jurisdictions will be with respect to 2045 and some upcoming capital program. So you're asking that the defer the
item. Yes, we would suggest that we defer the item.
Thank you. We'll move on to the information section of the agenda. Blair, are you ready to update us on FMO?
Yes, we did.
It's never been moved.
I know.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Our objective today for this FMO update is to provide you the monthly progress status on Metro's committed corrective action plan items in response to the Federal Transit Administration's Financial Management Oversight Review Report. And this month's report includes progress through the end of January. The FMO dashboard contains the four established FMO-related areas that we've been measuring. The first is completion risk of the 65 cap items by finding severity level. Then the status of FMO-related training in three key areas. A chart illustrated the quality and acceptance level of manually submitted drawdown packages. And the summary of the number of FTA recommendations fulfilled based upon our CAP submissions. This month's FMO dashboard reflects two updated focus areas since our January report, manual draw submission quality and FMO compliance training. Our CAPS completion status remains unchanged. 62 of 65 CAPS have been submitted to FTA. Two have been requested to be extended to the end of June, and the third has an original commitment due date at the end of June as well. With respect to our manual draw submission package quality, in January we received reimbursement approval for 100% of three draw packages having a total value of almost $64 million. This amount equated to 90% of the total dollar value of all prior manual submission reimbursements since March. Our cumulative reimbursement success rate, which is the approval rate of the total cumulative dollar amounts of manual draw submissions since imposition of the ECHO draw restriction in late March, increased from 95% to 97%. From March through January, $135 million has been drawn down on a total of $138.4 million worth of drawdown package submissions. The FMO compliance training graph illustrates the number of employees participating in training courses in the areas of asset management, grants management, and procurement. Although the actual number of employees trained lagged the total original estimates, all employees from training was required did receive training in these areas. Future training will be oriented for new employees and refresher courses for current employees. In January, 161 employees received asset management training, thereby achieving the objective of ensuring that all of our accountable property officers and property custodians were trained on proper requirements and procedures for asset management for federally funded assets. Our final dashboard quadrant chart reflects the number of CAPs submitted against the 9 material weakness and significant deficiency findings and the number of FMO report recommendations within those findings that our corrective action plan submissions have been deemed by the FDA as having been adequately fulfilled. The FMO findings that have been 100% fulfilled are highlighted in green. Open findings with recommendations still requiring confirmation of corrective action plans are the following. Budget controls and the cash grants management controls will be fulfilled by reconciliation of prior year grants and completion of all the budget adjustments necessary for those,
and those will be done by June 30th. Those are the extended caps, related to the extended caps. And then the FDA-funded assets and financial management system access, these two findings are expected to be fulfilled by our latest follow-up responses submitted on January 30th in response to FDA's December 22nd letter requesting further information on some of our 90-day due caps. Our summary timeline recaps the major milestone dates of corrective action plans submitted, follow-up requests received, and follow-up submissions provided, all since the final FMO report was issued in June of this year. Our timeline continues to expand and has been updated with the latest activity through January 31st, 2015. Since the last board FMO update, we submitted our follow-up responses to FDA's December 22nd letter on time. For this month's update summary, we received our largest dollar value manual reimbursement for $64 million. Asset management training was conducted for 161 employees. The balance of all WMATA's grant applications for federal fiscal years through up through 2014 were completed and submitted, with $311 million in formula grants having been awarded. And as an update to this slide, the $274 million balance in formula grants has now been certified by the Department of Labor and is in final FDA review. And the $148.5 million of PREA funding has been reviewed by FDA and passed on to the Department of Labor for their certification. As previously mentioned, we sent our requested cap follow-up responses to FDA on time. And lastly, we're pleased to welcome Elizabeth Sullivan to WMATA as our new Director of Internal Compliance. For our next steps, we remain committed to achieving the progress milestones for the extended FMO cap items and will continue conducting the monthly progress review status meetings with the FDA Region 3 staff. Our efforts continue with respect to identification, analysis, reconciliation, and settlement of any identified incorrect grant draws. And the new Internal Compliance Office and staff will be conducting scheduled follow-up reviews and long-term compliance monitoring to help ensure ongoing compliance with the FMO caps and proper adherence to updated internal controls. Mr. Chairman, that concludes this month's FMO update report. At this time, I'd be happy to answer any questions from the committee. Thank you.
Are there, excuse me, questions? Yes, Bolger.
Thanks so much. Could you go back a couple slides to the green boxes and the yet to be, it's like bars. There you go. Okay.
Yeah.
So middle of the middle bar towards the bottom. Financial management system access.
Right.
Is that the software program, Blair, the PeopleSoft, and the reconciliation or the budget stuff?
Right. It has to do with access controls of who has access to the system.
Okay. Where's then, help me out there, where's the maybe it's not up there, but we electronically or versus manually, the system goes, the grants go through the system, the PeopleSoft, and the, is that up there?
No, well, the grant draws were on the other chart, the grant draw submission quality. We measure that on the percent. When we submit a package, whether or not 100% of the package is approved or they send it back to us, only partially approved. So we have a 97% now success rate of all our dollars being approved since March.
But that's on manual mode, or is that?
Manual, yes.
Yeah. Now, the switch over, we've talked about this.
Let me just get some clear. When the manual mode works is we provide the documentation manually to the PMOC. The PMOC reviews the documentation. They approve it, let the Region 3 staff know. They open ECHO for us for a short period of time, and we draw the exact amount that they've approved.
Yeah.
And we let them know we've drawn it, we get the money, and then they close it back down.
Okay. So that's on manual mode?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, when do we go to what I'm more used to sort of automatic mode, where we have a software programs and hard, are we hardwired to do this electronically in the future?
Well, even when we were on automatic draw, we never had, it still took manual intervention to go into the ECHO system. It's not our system. That's the Treasury system to draw down the funds.
All right, so is that any of that changed over this FMO process, or is it still
the technology for actually drawing the funds has not changed.
Okay.
It's just the we now the the onus is on us for the due diligence to provide all the documentation, whereas in the past, once, you know, you're sort of on the honor system that you you have all the backup and then you draw your funds down.
Okay, thank you.
Obviously, we need to keep working with FTA to get to the point where they will lift all of the issues. I stay in touch with them. I think there are some good indications that they believe we're doing a good job. The fact that they've made the new grants is a very positive step. I also, I think I mentioned to most of you, in the president's budget that was submitted a couple of weeks ago, the administration proposes to lift the language in the appropriations bill that required certification that this process was coming along. They feel that by next year it will be far enough along that they can take off the training wheels with respect at least to their appropriations language. Congress may feel differently, but I'm at least happy the people we have to satisfy at the department believe we're making good progress. Any other questions? Thank you, Blair. Yes.
Out on Saturday, I got to mention the chairman working on Saturday morning in his robe about the FTA apportionments and some of the policy points that you just made. That was in the apportionment announcement by the Federal Transit Administration.
Yeah.
Anything else turn up on that? Because you highlighted a couple.
I haven't got anything back yet, but I promise that within the next few days we'll get a full analysis of next year's apportionments. And the thing I was particularly concerned about was, were there any new requirements or any new interpretations that we had to be sensitive to, recognizing that such changes have occurred in the past and went right by us without our knowing about them. We want an affirmative report from the staff. That
I don't have it memorized, but there was one general, well, your first comment was some practice that we have to do now or that we were not doing.
Yeah, I don't recall.
All right.
Anything else for Blair? Thank you for your help on that. The last item for today's agenda is a quick review of where we are at the midpoint in fiscal 2015. Hopefully, some degree of less than bad news.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, today I will update the committee on Metro's operating revenues, expenses, and ridership for the first half of FY15. And then John will provide an update on Metro's capital program delivery performance for the same period. As you know, Metro's operating budget provides resources for personnel, services, materials and supplies that support Metro Bus, Metro Rail, and Metro Access operations. And as you hear from John a little bit later today, Metro is also engaged in a large and aggressive capital investment program to maintain and upgrade its infrastructure. With respect to ridership, total system ridership for the first half of the year is 174 million trips, which is up almost 3 million trips compared to the same period last year. However, last year's ridership was, of course, affected by the federal government's shutdown that occurred in October, which significantly impacted rail ridership, and which therefore makes this comparison not really comparable. But when you add the increased ridership versus last year to the modest fare increase implemented at the end of June, the total passenger revenue for the first half of the year is up $24 million, again, which is expected. Compared to budget, as Mr. Goldman has intimated a little bit earlier today, both ridership and revenues are significantly off target, and we will talk a little bit about that as part of this presentation. This table summarizes Metro's operating performance for the first 6 months of FY15. So through December, Metro has a $2 million negative operating variance resulting primarily from a $16 million negative revenue variance that is largely offset by a $14 million positive variance in expenses. And as shown on this slide, Metro had actual revenues of $451 million for this period, again, primarily due to the passenger fare revenues, which individually was off by $13 million. And the reasons, again, include the transit benefit issue that Director Borgia mentioned a little bit earlier, among other factors. With respect to operating revenues, it was also, all right, operating expenses, it was also under budget at $872 million, again, primarily due to lower service expenses, as well as energy expenses, again, tied in part to the declining prices. With respect to Metro Access, ridership was million trips for the period, which is an increase of 70,000 trips over this timeline, or 90,000 trips over the budget itself. And when you go to looking at operating expenses overall, personnel expenses, which is obviously part of total expenses, was $643 million, which was essentially flat to budget. Salaries and wages were slightly higher or slightly lower to budget, but fringe was slightly higher, and at the end, they essentially washed each other out. On the non-personnel side, non-personnel expenses were $229 million, which was favorable to budget by $15 million. Again, tied essentially to the savings that you saw with respect to services and energy cost, tied to both price and utilization levels. The last item in this case is that materials was actually higher than budget by almost $8 million. But that, again, reflects some of the changes and some of the realignments that we will be making later in the year with respect to the budget itself. Looking down the line, and as you will recall, at the beginning of the fiscal year, the general manager committed to reducing the operating cost by 2.5% in order to achieve sufficient savings to address three issues. The first being addressing the deficit from FY14, $23 million. The second was addressing what he saw and what the organization at that point with respect to soft ridership, particularly at rail. And finally, to address the additional costs expected with respect to Metro's response to the FMO findings and the compliance activities that Metro committed to. And I'm glad to report that at this point, that commitment is working. With a $14 million operating cost savings, despite approximately $15 million of capital preventive maintenance costs that are still sitting on the operating budget and that will be transferred later in the year. And as you will recall, part of the delay in the transfer is the ongoing conversations with FTA to make sure that we're doing it right. And we expect to resolve this over the next few months. So once those transfers occur, Metro's net operating position as of December will be a positive $13 million. And if you take a similar view going forward, expecting ridership to be depressed as it was in the first quarter, we will still end up with a sufficient surplus to address the deficit from FY14. At this point, unless there are questions, I'll transfer it over to John to speak about the capital program delivery performance.
Questions about the operating side?
Dennis, I just want to understand what you've just been talking about, and that is how the deficit from 2014 gets wiped out by the surplus that is in 2015. Now, I guess there's a chart that is the one that says FY 2015 second quarter operating result. I just want to make sure I understand that, because it's showing a negative $2 million, meaning that it's $2 million over budget in terms of creating a greater subsidy need of $2 million. But then you're saying that there's some magic that moves the preventive maintenance, which I guess is something that's included in these expense numbers, and that's going to be moved out of the operating budget into the capital budget.
That's correct.
And why does – what is the timing of that? Why does that why is that shown as an expense if it gets transferred, and what is the – what is the accounting process that you have to go through to take that out so that essentially what's shown here as being over budget turns out that we're $13 million below budget?
Right. So if you think back to the FY15 budget that the board approved, there is a $30.7 million preventive maintenance line in that budget. So the history and the process has been as those expenses occur, that those expenses are captured in there. What has been going on as part of, again, the FMO review and our need to be extremely cautious in identifying costs and making sure that those costs do not violate any other provisions is that both, particularly with respect to materials, though we want to make sure that those materials are purchased consistent with the FDA guidelines. And so once that determination is concluded, we will transfer those costs that are currently sitting in the operating budget to the capital budget. That's one. The other piece of it, obviously, is the fourth account, which is labor costs, which, again, could be part of that. So, but at the end of the day, by the end of the fiscal year, there's $30 million of costs that ultimately will, and are truly capital costs, that are truly preventive maintenance that will be going to the capital program, but at this point still have not been made, and we expect to be making those transfers within the next 60 to 90 days.
And so when you make that transfer, the figure there that shows negative $2
million right.
will be a positive $13
million. That's correct.
And you're forecasting that this process will repeat itself in the next 6 months of the FY15, so that the total positive will be around 25, 26 million.
Which will allow us then.
And that will cover the deficit of 22, 23, 24 million.
Correct.
From FY14.
That's correct. That correct.
Okay, that's the one. Thank you.
The budgeting of preventive maintenance as a capital item has been a regular feature in the WMATA budget. There's some of us who aren't as thrilled with that as others. At one point, it was increased substantially and then decreased again, but $30 million has been kind of the equilibrium point. But in order to use federal money to pay those costs, we have to meet the federal rules, and that's been part of the FMO process to be sure that we're fully in compliance. But the work is underway, and the operating budget will get the benefit of that before the year is out. But it's not as if we got to the middle of the year and said, let's dip into some new pot. It was exercising what was already in place.
No, I understood the end result. I'm just trying to really understand intellectually how you get
progress.
There.
Work in progress.
It seems as though it's, yeah. I won't say it's trickery, but it seems as though it's some kind of accounting magic. There is legal magic, yeah, definitely.
Any other questions on the operating side? If we keep it up, we'll maybe get through the year as well as paying back from last year. So that's clearly the goal.
That's correct. Yeah.
One other thing in terms of operating, not results, but operating budget. In the next month or two before we get the budget adoption, I assume we'll take another look at FY16 ridership expectations. And perhaps by that time, Mr. Bulger will have gotten our transit benefit back. All will be good. It's riding on you, Tom.
Yep.
Yes, right. Yep. Capital.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Thomas. I'm pinch hitting for Mr. Bittar, who's out sick today. The slide up there on the screen is the overview of the capital program, the nine groups of the that make up the program. This year's budget was approved at $1.1 billion. One of the decisions that was made in the aftermath of the FMO audit last spring was to defer several capital projects through the first 6 months of this fiscal year as we put budget control and procurement processes in place. As a result of that deferral, we have revised downward our projection for this capital this year to $840 million. The next few slides have highlights of some of these programs. The first one is on the bus and metro access. On the buses rehab, that's currently shown as red. The plan was for 100 buses to be rehabbed this year. We believe that we are going to be able to do the other 75 by the end of this fiscal year to get that goal completely met. On the buses delivered under CIP 006, the 60 buses delivered thus far are the only buses that we will be getting this year. The manufacturer has had some delays in their productivity and their manufacturing and will not be able to deliver the other 21 this fiscal year.
Could under, you tell me who the bus manufacturer is, just for public disclosure?
I think the delay is because we've...
No. Who?
Well, New Flyer.
Okay.
Remember, the contract was with NABBY, that we transferred ownership contract over to New Flyer, and that delay created it. Those are on schedule now to be produced, but not this year.
Under CIP 003, we're doing expansion buses of 20 for this fiscal year. We've already received 18, and we'll receive the other two by the end of the fiscal year. And on the metro access, although there's none been delivered so far, past activities have shown that those 150 will show up late in this fiscal year, and we will receive all of those. The next section is on track and structures. I wasn't going to go through all of these. I was just going to touch on the first two, CIP 18. The joints welded, we don't think we're going to reach that goal of 1,200. We're a little under half, but one of the reasons that we have such a low number so far this year is that there was a decision made not to grant the revenue service adjustments that were needed during the month of December so they could do the work. So we're going to end up being below 1,200. And on CIP 19, the engineers and the maintainers are revisiting the floating slab program. They're going to make a decision by the end of this month how many more of the floating slabs we're going to rehab this fiscal year, but we know it will not be 750. The remainder of the items on the list here, we're confident that we'll reach the goals set.
Could you just clarify for me then, the color code here on 0019, is that yellow or green or a mixture of yellow and green?
It's
it
yellow.
Ain't the same as the other ones.
It's yellow as a warning, but... We know we're not going to make it because so this, we're proposing.
A clear yellow would be a better representation of this, if not a red, and similarly to the other, just keeping these reports simple for those of us who look at the pictures.
Yes, sir.
Yes.
The next grouping is the maintenance and other facilities, which happens to be my program. These are bus garages. First one is the Royal Street Bus Garage, also known as the Cinderbed Road Bus Garage, the replacement for Royal Street. We've been going through a very lengthy permitting process for that project. We actually are drafting up a proposal for the board to act on in 2 weeks to allow us to sign some permits that Fairfax County requires. So hopefully that will be nearing the end of the permitting difficulties we've had with that, and we'll actually be able to move into meaningful construction here in the spring. Southern Avenue Bus Garage was one of the projects that was designated for deferral. We have given notice to proceed to the contractor for that replacement of Southern Avenue, and we're moving very well in the design and permitting at this time. Test Track and Commissioning Facility, the commissioning building itself is going to be completed next Wednesday, so that'll become Metro. We'll take that from the contractor at that day. The test track itself, we're projecting to have that done by the end of May. the District 2 Police Substation, CIP 101. We had an opening ceremony on December 20th.
Great facility.
It's a great facility. It's a great event, and we're glad to have been able to accomplish that successfully. And the last project is the Special Operations Facility. We expect to have that complete in April. We're working on trying to do a parking lot, and this weather is not suitable for that.
Mr. Giancola, do you have a question?
Yeah, is that the report, Mr. Thomas?
I'm sorry?
Is that the end of your report?
No, there's two more slides.
I can wait till the end.
Okay,
The next slide is maintenance equipment. The first one is CIP 139. I understand Mr. Bitar has explained in the previous update that the contractor who was doing this work for us went out of business late last June. So we took a hit on our productivity. We revisited our plan for this year. We recovered from that. We got another contractor. But we only believe we're going to be able to get about 10,000 linear feet of power cable replacement. For the track circuits, we're showing low numbers there in terms of actuals completed compared to the plan for this year. But we have several revenue service adjustments planned, one this weekend and several more in the spring, that will allow the rest of these modules and bonds to be replaced, and we believe we'll be able to reach the goal that was set for this fiscal year.
Just a question on the power cables. Is this the area where we're actually looking at possibly reconfiguring the priorities to replace certain cables ahead of others?
I can't answer that.
Okay. I know that's one of the 10 follow-on items.
I think Mr. Troop's going to.
The short answer is that the power cable process
might open up to do
certain. We would have thought accelerate.
Thanks.
The last slide is for vertical transportation. CIP 72 is the elevator rehabs. We had completed 6 by the end of December, and at that same time, 4 more were already in progress. So we'll be able to easily reach the 15 set for this year. Escalators rehab, 14 were completed at the end of December, with 8 more in progress, so we'll be able to reach the goal of 29 for this year. And lastly, the escalators replaced, 6 completed. We will have the other 6 completed by the end of this fiscal year. That's the end of my presentation.
Yeah, thank you for your report, Mr. Thomas. Looking at the capital program from a macro point of view, it looks like you've expended in 6 months, $264 million. You said the adjusted budget was down to, because of the FMO report, down to 841. Did I hear that right?
840.
My concern is execution. And you're basically going to tell me that you're going to spend in the next 6 months close to $580 million. And I'm really going to ask you the question, is that a reasonable expectation? I mean, are you really going to meet that?
I think what we've seen in previous fiscal years is our expenditures have gone up significantly in the second half of the fiscal year.
But by that much?
I don't know what the actual numbers are for previous fiscal years, but I know hearing reports that our numbers in the second half always go up higher than they were always in the first half.
Okay, I hear you. I'm just very concerned over the execution, the expectations we have with our capital program, and certainly in relation to their 2025 expectations. I think we probably really do need as a board to look at that to see whether we're really overestimating our expectation here.
I think our expectation for 2016 is to be even higher than.
Yeah, well, that's because I think of the procurement of the cars, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. But
I think we do need to look at all of that. We're also looking at whether some of the cash that's now not being spent because of deferred implementation could be helpful in solving other budget problems that we have. Yeah.
expand on that? So help me out here. We had a FY 2015 approved budget of, back to the slide Tony was talking about, of $1.102 billion. Tony, assuming they make the target at 837, you net that out, that's a couple hundred million dollars. And where does that money end up? Does it get carried forward? Can we claim it? Can we use it for something else?
It's still there in terms of the long life of the capital program. Those projects would happen to have to be paid for. It is possible that the sources that would have paid for it, particularly looking at 2016, where we have a real crunch of a problem, could be transferred, perhaps restored later on. One of the avenues we need to look at. Actually, following on some suggestions that Marilyn had given of a mixed operating and capital cash way to solve budget problems.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
It would be true, I think, to say that the that we're doing this on a reimbursable basis now. So, and so the money's still in the jurisdiction until WMATA asks to be reimbursed. So it's not sitting here at WMATA.
That's true. We'd be really rich if we had all that money if we were earning even part
of it. No, we wouldn't be really rich.
That's why we changed the CFA.
That's why we changed the rules.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just clarify that a little bit. The basis that we're not on a reimbursement basis, we're on a cash expenditure basis. So the amount that's billed each quarter to the jurisdictions is intended to pay for expenditures in that next quarter and the period after that. So it's not strictly a reimbursement. That's actually how our federal program works. Just in time funding is sort of how it's designed.
I stand corrected. Thank you, Mr.
And to the extent
Webster.
That some of this in the jurisdictions is paid with PAYGO resources as opposed to capital funding, we want to look at those options.
Mr. Thomas, I just had a question or two along the same slide and following up on Mr. Giancola's question. The chart shows that on two of the categories, vehicles, the percentage completed in 6 months is fairly low, 20% for vehicles, 15% for maintenance facilities. On those two capital project areas, are those ones where we can expect a greater level of completion on the next 6 months going towards 70 or 80%, or do you think that these are areas where it's very unlikely that we're going to do much better in the second half of the year as in the first half?
On the vehicles, if you go to the next slide, couple of things that are driving the dollars, you can see that the 25 of the 100 are the bus rehabs, and we have high confidence that we're going to be able to do 75 this 6 months, so that'll reflect a much higher expenditure. And then in the Metro Access fleet, we hadn't accepted any vehicles this first 6 months, and we believe we'll have all 150 by the end of the fiscal year.
So that'll come closer to the 100%.
Correct.
Or close. And the other
maintenance.
I'd also like to add, going back to the discussion that Dennis had earlier on preventive maintenance, that's actually in this category. So when those transfers occur, those numbers will improve.
So that'll jump up that percentage for the maintenance category.
Yes.
Thank you.
So on the other question you had is on the maintenance facilities, which were all of my projects are. The two big drivers this year under that are the two bus garages, and a contributor to the reduction from the 1.1 to the 840 are these two projects, because we're not going to be able to deliver them as much as we had thought we were going to be able to do this year.
So those are ones where delayed contract completion will move over into FY16 or beyond.
Correct.
Any other questions on capital? I think that completes our agenda. We're out of here before 4 o'clock. Exhausted. Everyone should be thinking about the next 2 weeks, what we need to do to try to get to an agreement that we could all bring forward in lieu of or as part of the docket agenda.
Yep.
And with that, meeting adjourned.